When the Reverend John Winthrop first arrived in the New World in 1630 with a band of Puritan refugees from religious oppression and dropped anchor in Salem Harbor, he preached a sermon from the deck of the ship, the Arabella, in which he said, "We must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." His dream for America was of a sacred commonwealth, a city of justice and righteousness, a city in which people care about one another's welfare. As Winthrop put it, "We must be knit together in this work as one. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body." So the Puritans proceeded to create their golden cities in New England. And although they often were theologically narrow and intolerant themselves in some ways, their self-governed communities did pave the way for the great experiment in freedom and democracy that is the United States. The foundation stone of their societies was the belief that one should sacrifice personal wealth and extravagance for the greater good of the whole community. So now, having set the scene for my talk this morning in 17th century New England, I'm going to whisk you all now off into the future, as envisioned by the science fiction series Star Trek. In that series, there's a race of beings called the Ferengi, from the planet Ferenginar. Some of you know this. The Ferengi culture is based on acquisition and greed. Their Bible is a book titled The Rules of Acquisition, a book that has actually been compiled and is available to purchase. My son has a copy, from which I got some of what I'm going to share here. Here are sample rules from the Ferengi Rules of Acquisition. Never let family stand in the way of opportunity. Anything worth doing is worth doing for money. A Ferengi without profit is no Ferengi at all. Never place friendship before profit. The most beautiful thing about a tree is what you do with it after you cut it down. There's nothing wrong with charity as long as it winds up in your pocket. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine also. Enough is never enough. Compassion is no substitute for profit. Greed is eternal. And the clincher for us humans is rule number 284. Deep down, everyone's a Ferengi. Of course, all the humanoid species envisioned by Star Trek are projections. They are aspects of humanity. And there is, I think, a part of each of us that is at least a bit Ferengi-like, a bit acquisition-oriented, and even greedy. Recently, on an airplane flight, I found myself getting things out of the pocket to read and absent-mindedly thumbing through one of those catalogs of grown-up toys and gadgets. You've seen them. They have scale model cars, old-fashioned style jukeboxes, little electric doodads that create an array of colors inside a glass globe, police radar detection devices, and so on. So I'm thumbing through this, and I admit that I found myself looking a bit covetously at a few of those items, thinking, this one looks nice. This is an interesting toy. I wouldn't mind having one of these. I want this gadget. Did you ever find yourself in one of those little acquisitive stupors? I had another voice faintly reminding me that I don't really need these things and shouldn't spend my limited resources on such frivolities. I felt a bit like a character you see in cartoons with a little devil perched on one shoulder and a little angel on the other. Fortunately, I snapped out of it before I reached for my credit card. And of course, they let you order it right on the plane and they'll have it for you when you arrive. That state that I was temporarily in is, of course, carefully cultivated by ad agencies. They want us to want things. They drone on in print, on TV and radio, about this jazzy little sports car, that cool pair of jeans, that indispensable vacation cruise. They would have us believe that the pursuit of happiness in our Declaration of Independence is the pursuit of more and still more stuff. Happiness as self-gratification. A bumper sticker I once saw ironically sums up the underlying motivation of our lives as cultivated by our consumer-oriented culture. I'm sure you've seen it. It just says, "The one who dies with the most toys wins." Well, I don't think that's what Jefferson and the other founders meant by stating that we are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Significantly, Jefferson did not use John Locke's then familiar trilogy, Life, Liberty, and Property. Property and the pursuit of happiness were not one and the same in the founders' minds. As Gary Willis put it in his book, Inventing America, when Jefferson spoke of pursuing happiness, he had nothing vague or private in mind. He meant a public happiness, which is measurable, which is indeed the test and judgment of any government. What a concept! The idea that government is meant to make possible the happiness of the public, the happiness of as many of its citizens as possible. George Washington elaborated on this public-minded idea of happiness when he said in his first inaugural address, "There is no truth more thoroughly established than that there exists in the economy and course of nature an indissoluble union between virtue and happiness, between duty and advantage, between the genuine maxims of an honest and magnanimous policy and the solid rewards of public prosperity and felicity." What a statement! A union between virtue and happiness, duty and advantage, generosity and public prosperity. The founders seemed to believe that with the liberty they fought so hard for should come a sense of responsibility, a duty to work for the public welfare, for the common good. Now, of course, these same founders had some serious blind spots. They did not grant the same rights and responsibilities to those who were not landowners, or those who were not male, or those who were owned as slaves. But they did have a vision, even if an incomplete one, a vision of a society in which the greater good, public happiness, was put in the foreground. Some years ago, a study was published titled "The Day America Told the Truth," in which the results of extensive interviews were summarized. the researchers, James Patterson and Peter Kim, found that our moral fiber seems to be eroding. We are sadly very far from the ideal of Washington and Jefferson, where the greater good is more important than getting goods. Most Americans admit to being willing to lie, to cheat, or steal for a few extra bucks. And 70% couldn't name even one modern moral hero, results of this survey said. Also, more than half of us have been victims of a major crime, and 1 in 7 carries a weapon. The researchers concluded that, in their words, the United States has become a meaner, greedier, colder, more selfish, and uncaring place. Many are uncaring, indifferent, or cynical, even about exercising their right and responsibility to vote. In 1872, Susan B. Anthony bravely and illegally cast a vote to make her point about women needing to get the vote, and she was arrested. At the time, the vote was denied to, and here's the list, idiots, criminals, lunatics, and women. I remember just a couple of decades ago, you may remember as well, in the Philippines, people were guarding the ballot boxes literally with their lives, trying to ensure a truly democratic election under the repressive Marcos regime. Here today, the once hard-won right to vote is taken for granted. It is depressing to realize how relatively few people who are qualified to vote in this country actually do so. In the last presidential election, 54.9% of those eligible voted. Now, it's often said that in a midterm election like the last one, the turnout is smaller. But even for the one before that, when Obama ran against McCain, and Obama ran for the first time, only 57.1% of those eligible to vote actually voted. Where were the others? Why didn't they voice their opinion and do their duty and vote? Simple thing to do, although some states are trying to make it harder. And that's something we should always fight against. But nowadays, we tend to measure our progress as a society by citing statistics like the gross national product. We are oriented toward a consumerist way of life, which involves getting and spending, that kind of mentality. According to theologian John Cobb and economist Herman Daly, from their book For the Common Good, we in Europe and North America are now in the third epoch of the last 1,000 years of Western culture. The first epoch they call the epoch of Christianism, in which most people's identity was tied up with being Christian. This is Europe and America. And many were willing to fight and to die for Christianity, traveling many miles to foreign lands if necessary, to engage in crusades to convert non-believers. Cobb and Daly say that after the religious wars of the 17th century between Protestants and Catholics, during which a third of Central Europe's population was killed, Christians became less motivated to fight for religious turf, and they turned power over to political leaders. The church became less powerful than the state, and the next age, the age of nationalism, began. People in the nationalist epoch identified themselves primarily as citizens of a particular country, for which they would fight and die as people once had for Christianity. The extremes of nationalism became evident during World War II, and after that horror, nations bound themselves together to form the United Nations and to establish the World Bank and the International Money Fund. So this entered ushered in the third epoch that Cobb and Daly call the epoch of economism, which we're still in. Although religion and national identity are still important, the authors say that the focus of our concern today is on our own economic well-being. Our decisions as individuals, as communities, and as nations are now based on economic considerations. Although there are some benefits to this era of economism when compared with the extremes of Christianism and nationalism, they see economism overall as a recipe for disaster on a world scale. Small and once self-sufficient countries have become dependent on the world market. Free trade agreements allow corporations to move their plants wherever they can do business the most cheaply, exploiting labor and polluting the environment. Economism also fosters an extreme individualism. In earlier eras, people were more communal, sacrificing their own interests for their tribal, religious, ethnic, or national community. Now, we try to maximize our own individual economic advantage, and many seem to believe that pushing their own economic interests to the limit will somehow work to the benefit of everyone as well. You could certainly argue with the details of Cobb and Daly's broad characterizations of the three eras, but it seems to me that they got it right with respect to what motivates people in the U.S. today. All we have to do to see that we are in an area of economism is to listen what so many politicians promise. Always fewer taxes, lower taxes, no new taxes, tax cuts, so that we can have more purchasing power. And they promise continuing economic expansion, even though this often takes a toll on the environment and digs us deeper into debt. Even when they dare speak in support of environmental policies, politicians feel constrained to use the argument that protecting the earth can be compatible with economic growth and development if we do it right. Now, I don't mean to say that it's unreasonable for us to be concerned with our own economic well-being, and it certainly is a step in the right direction to look toward ecologically sustainable economic development. But when economic self-interest is the major, almost the only focus of our national politics, we can lose sight of the communal and compassionate dimensions of our being, which I believe firmly are still latent within most of us, whatever our political stripe. I'm told that in Scandinavian democracies, as a contrast, people who are economically successful expect to pay a very large share of their incomes in taxes, upwards of 50 to 60%. They see it as their duty as responsible citizens to help those who are less fortunate. And I am told they are not given to whining about taxes the way Americans do. I would love to hear our politicians, our American politicians, say right up front, because more than 20% of our children are born into poverty, because we need to be fiscally responsible to future generations and must reduce our national deficit, because education is so important to help people help themselves, because we need to protect our environment for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Folks, honestly, we must raise taxes on all but the very poorest among you. And I promise you that the funds we collect from all of you who can pay will go to help those who are in need and will help protect the earth, which so generously sustains us all. This much honesty might unfortunately be political suicide in today's economist climate, but wouldn't it be refreshing? To be fair, some politicians are calling for higher taxes, But they always stress that the increase focuses on those in the highest income brackets. It's important, but all of us who can would have to pitch in if we want to take care of those who are at the bottom, those who have been essentially left behind in the ever-present scramble for our own economic well-being. Compassion and a sense of community is not dead in the American soul, but it is ailing. We see it spring up each year after Election Day, during the holidays, when caring and generosity toward those in need are evident everywhere. Wouldn't it be exciting and transforming if this kind of compassion started earlier and persisted all year long? What if more Americans went into the voting booth each year aware of that little devil and the little angel on their shoulders, those voices we carry within us? What if each voter listened carefully to what both voices, the voice of self-interest and the voice of compassion, had to say? And what if each person would vote according to the voice of compassion, at least as often as the other voice, following the dictates of that voice that asks for some sacrifice, the whispering angel that speaks for the common good? I offer you this closing thought. You have heard it said that if you die with the most toys, you're the winner. But that's a lie. The one who dies with the most love, that's the one who wins.